Hello and welcome to the podcast PFI Talks, which is brought to you by Prague Finance Institute, an affiliate of the leading Czech economics research center, Serge EI. It is my pleasure to welcome Christian Orbán, the founder of CEE-based investment company Orient. Hello.
Hi. And if I may...
You may, certainly.
It's just we really have two head offices, one in Prague, one in Budapest. I personally live in Budapest, but we have an almost equally sized office in Prague.
Before we dive in into the sort of the two, let's say, passions of your professional life, and that's macroeconomics, finance, and obviously private equity, I have to ask you about your last name. Any relations to Viktor Orbán, the Prime Minister of Hungary?
No, not at all. A lot of reservations, though.
A lot of reservations about the surname or the Prime Minister?
It's the Prime Minister I have a lot of reservations about.
So this podcast is not really meant to, you know, doesn't really focus on politics, except geopolitics. And I think we will get into that because it's a great opportunity to talk to someone who has actually built a fairly big fund out of scratch in the region, focusing on international audience. And before we started taping, we were discussing how you actually started the fund. Can you walk us through that story? Because it's amazing. I mean, just hearing you talk about starting a private equity fund out of Budapest in 2007, that's not a really great timing, to be honest.
That is as bad of a timing as it gets. Yeah, we started in 2007. And I had a mentor. I had a person who really helped me and without whom there would be no Orient today. He was previously U.S. ambassador to Hungary, George Herbert Walker, his name. Mm-hmm. And he has enabled me to deliver my pitch to something like 100 different potential investors.
How long did it take?
2.5 years. We toured the U.S. very extensively and he accompanied me and he gave a lot of credibility to what I was trying to tell. Mm-hmm. And at the end, out of that 100, four of them said that, okay, I'm ready to invest. And even those four, they clearly have given me the benefit of the doubt because of Ambassador Walker.
Okay, understand. So, okay, when it comes to the return on investment in terms of the potential investors you talk to, that's not really, you know, that's nothing to be really proud of. But if they actually, those four investors enabled you to actually get the start off the ground, let it go and make it running, then it's well done. But you started in 2007, then obviously the great financial crisis came. So was there some sort of, how did it change or how was the dynamic going on just before the collapse of Lehman Brothers and everything else that came after?
So it was pretty amazing. So there are two lines to this story. One is our personal story. And the personal story was that we had verbal commitments of something like $40 million dollars before Lehman went down. And when Lehman went down, it essentially has evaporated.
So we had to start again.
Almost completely again. We had one last anchor investor who was ready to give up when he read at the front page of the New York Times on March 14th, 2008, that Hungary was on the verge of a civil war, which is total nonsense. I mean, absolute nonsense. And then the guy said that, you know, I'm pulling out my commitment. And because, you know,
How do you respond to that? How do you say, well, there's no civil war risk?
Yeah, it's luckily by then I have known a few analysts who were covering the region from New York and London. So I arranged that they had a talk with this investor. And they told him that, you know, this is as close to ridiculous as it is possible. So that saved the day. And then between 2008 March and January 2010, we have managed to get the ball rolling. But it was an intense period, very difficult period. So that was, you know, it also entailed, I got into debt. I was 1 million euros in debt by the end of that period. because I had to fund my small staff. I had to fund an office. I had to fund a lot of things. Mm-hmm. There were two people who were kind enough to lend me money. Mm-hmm. And I was able to sustain the company. And by January 2010, we were able to launch. So it was very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what was your first fund? How, what was the size? What was the time horizon? And what did you focus on?
Yeah, it was a small fund, $25 million. And we did it between 2010 and 15-16. We did four companies. It were, we had Medicover in the Czech Republic, which worked out very nicely for us. And we had three other companies. We essentially developed our business model then. That's when we have figured out what we want to do in the longer term. And that's when we have identified this kind of more long-term horizon that we are trying to take. It has worked out very, very nicely, and it enabled us to get not only these anchor investors who were there at the beginning, but also some very large institutions from New York.
So what is the rate of reinvestment? From
Oh, it's 100%. Everybody. We kept everybody, and that goes for the third fund as well, yes.
So now you have three funds. You know, the portfolio for the, you know, for the investment company of your size is actually fairly interesting because it goes across various different industries, you know, as you mentioned, medical, you know, retail, but it also covers a pretty broad geographic footprint. How do you manage that?
So what we do is we are trying to identify a few megatrends that we believe in. Mm-hmm. I mean, I give you an obvious one, loneliness. We think that people are becoming more and more lonely. Mm-hmm. And as a result, there are a few things that make sense to invest into a longer term. We are looking for these megatrends because they help you ride through the ups and downs of the cycle. Mm-hmm. But to really, you want to avoid the megatrends that everybody else talks about because they tend to be overvalued. So you are looking for the few megatrends that you think you have identified, but you believe that maybe it has avoided the attention of most others. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we are able to invest in a reasonable valuation, not these, you know, really crazy ones. Like if a few years ago somebody said social media, I mean, that garnered just ridiculous valuation. Mm-hmm. So we are trying to avoid those. So we have this megatrend-driven approach. But once we have identified it and we have identified the industries which are really exploiting that megatrend, then you already have an industry-specific knowledge. And once you have an industry-specific knowledge, it is relatively easy to go to a new country because you at least understand the industry. So we have this rule that it has to, so we are okay if the industry is new if it is in a country where we are comfortable with, or it is okay if it is a new country, if it is an industry that we are familiar with.
Okay.
But it cannot be both. Mm-hmm. So that's how we are trying to bridge this.
But can we circle back to that megatrend, loneliness? So what are the industries that are actually within this megatrend?
So I use loneliness because we haven't invested it yet, so I'm not giving away anything. But loneliness, so obviously pets. Mm-hmm. Pets are huge. As people are becoming lonelier, they are becoming more attached to their pets. They are ready to spend more and more money on their pets. So that's one of them. The other is as they are lonelier, they have more you know, mental hygienic problems. So anything that is related to solving those problems, mm-hmm. either through you know, pharma or through counseling, it is poised to grow very, very steadily, both in Western Europe and in our part of the world.
So, within that trend, because you mentioned, you know, mental hygiene,
yeah.
Put it this way, I mean, there has been a lot of players in the tech sphere of, you know, I mean, subsegment of tech,
yeah.
Coming up with all sorts of apps. Yeah. But the more I listen to you, the more I think that you, and looking at your portfolio, you do avoid tech.
we avoid anything which is unreasonably valued.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but is there anything reasonably valued in the tech sector now?
So I think B2C tech is ridiculously valued. B2C tech is like a lottery. I'm sure there are a few players who will make it, just as somebody will hit the lottery. But there are so many investors who are trying that they are really burning cash. And there are these very interesting long-term studies that I could name two very interesting phenomena in this regard. One of them is that if you're looking at VC, venture capital, where the venture capital industry earns its cost of money, it is only in certain parts of the United States and in China where it has earned its cost of money in the past 25 years. And the reason for that is that in tech, if you want, in B2C tech, if you want to make it big, if you want to become a unicorn, then you have to be in a position to become the dominant player in the market. Now, in B2C world, if you are not coming from the largest markets in the world, you have extremely small chance to become a dominant player globally. So you have to come from the US or you have to come from China. You cannot come from the Czech Republic. You cannot even come from Germany. So this is...
Except Wirecard, they tried that.
You're right. And that's just a great example.
By the way, the one guest before you was Dan McCrum, the FT journalist who actually broke that story.
I think that was just the most amazing story. And how FT handled that, I'm amazed. I think that was just a fantastic case of journalism.
You cannot come from Germany, I swear.
So that's the B2C angle. You know, you have to come from the US and you have to come from China if you want to make it big in B2C. But if you're talking about B2B, it is actually a very different world. Because in B2B, the center of the world is Germany and certain parts of China. So all of a sudden, if you are from the Czech Republic, you are very close to the center of the universe. And B2B tech is taking off much slower than B2C tech, partly because these large players, these large industrial players, want to keep a piece of the action. So it is harder to come in as a VC player and take advantage of them. So it will be slower, and it will be more attached to very large existing companies. But it is happening, and that part of digitization is actually, I think, is the digitization where European players will have a chance. So we actually like digitization, but we like it if it is an industry-specific solution. If somebody can demonstrate that it provides a solution for an industry. And by, you know... We are not early stage investors, so that's a different type of risk. That's a different type of portfolio strategy. Because if you do early stage, you have to have, I don't know, 15, 20, 25 investments, because only a few of them will make it or only one will make it. We are just very different investors. We invest into 5-6 companies and we want all of them to make it. So our logic just does not allow us to be early stage investors. But generally, we are big believers in B2B tech, not big believers in European B2C tech.
When it comes to that, how do you actually decide where can you actually really focus your investments regionally speaking? You said you had an office in Prague and that you are limiting the risk by sticking to the industry that you know. But, you know, you obviously want to be a broader CEE investment fund. So can you actually be managing investments in other countries in the region out of these two locations? Or do you have to actually follow those investments with a new location, office, rep office?
I think that we can do one company, two companies, if it is out of area. But sooner or later, we have to follow. I mean, we have set our sights on Germany. We have a very exciting company in Germany. We are looking at another one. So sooner or later, I would say sooner, that will mandate us to set up a small operation in southern Germany. Mm-hmm. We are looking at Baden-Württemberg and Bavaria because it is relatively easy to handle from Prague. Mm-hmm. And also because for the mental map of Germans who live there, we are part of the universe. If you go to North Rhine-Westphalian, then you're not. From Düsseldorf, you're not part of the universe. So, you know, we are sticking to the things, sticking to the places where we have something to show. People can connect to us, and we are not viewed as these super exotic investors or owners. I mean, we will be viewed as exotic owners anyhow. But at least they can relate to us at some level. So so we are trying to take our time. We are trying to do it one by one, building ourselves up gradually, not getting ahead of ourselves too much. Because in our business, you can be... So the kind of thing that we try to do, you really need extraordinary good colleagues. Mm-hmm. They need to do stuff which goes well beyond what private equity investors usually do. It's not like that my colleagues are doing board meetings and Excel sheets. That is 20% of their time. Mm-hmm. They also have to do, they have to be there at the company. I mean, they are at the company site 3 days a week.
Oh, so you do have a hands-on approach.
Absolutely.
To the, let's say, opcos.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We have to be there.
So how big is your staff, actually? I mean, I looked at the team. I mean,
it's not huge. It's not huge. They are just really good. It's I think it's 17 people right now, and I think that they are just really. I mean, in my opinion, they are the best and the brightest from their generation.
And is it difficult for you to actually get new talent?
It is very difficult.
Would it be easier if you decide to relocate to London?
Probably yes, because the pool is bigger, but at the same time, it is also important that we should be able to relate to the companies we work with. All of our companies are on the countryside. Mm-hmm. So you need people who can go to a countryside company, can work with the CEO, but also can work with the mid-management, in some cases can work with people who are not in mid-management. And it requires certain skills. First of all, you cannot be arrogant. And that already disqualifies 80% of the finance industry. So it is very hard. You cannot come there as the Prague guy or the Prague gal. You cannot, you know, act like that. You actually have to become, to some extent, part of that organization. And that is not a trivial task for finance types.
When it comes to... investment projects that you are looking at, how many balls do you have to keep in the air at the same time before you decide this is the investment we want to follow? In other words, what is the sort of a churn ratio of those that you just reject, those rejections?
So historically, we invest one out of 100 companies that we look into. Now, that includes even companies that we just take a look at and pass on it immediately.
So it takes you a few minutes. So
yeah, yeah. Even it includes even the few minutes ones, yes. Mm-hmm. But it's 1 to 100. Mm-hmm.
And how many people actually do work on evaluating these investment opportunities? How many people get the info packs and then go into the actual, you know, NDA-based pitch or...
So all of our assessments, so there is an assessment team which is led by one of our colleagues who has been with us since founding. There are three of us who have been there since founding. Hmm. And one of us is really handling this one, the whole process of assessment. Always there is a team of one or two people who do the deeper assessments. And then, you know, this by now, this is a formalized process. Hmm. We have several steps. But what is important that the actual decision is taken on a meeting where everybody is there.
Mm-hmm. So all hands.
Even analysts have to be there. And what I try to say, when an analyst comes on board, you know, they have meetings with everybody in the company. On the meetings with me, I always tell them, you are not here to speak your word, you know, to speak when you agree. Here, everybody is great at agreeing with himself or herself. You are valued when you are willing to speak up when you disagree. And we all understand that you're junior, so in 9 out of 10 cases, your disagreement, we can sort of argue away. But for that one case, when you are seeing something that nobody else does, your contribution will be very much valued. So I try to tell all of my colleagues, and I think they're pretty good at this, is that speak, especially if you disagree.
And it doesn't matter if you make a fool of yourself or it
absolutely doesn't matter because all of us make fools of ourselves from time to time. I do it pretty frequently.
Let's switch to the other hat of yours as someone focusing on economics and finance. What would you say to those arguments about, you know, everybody's concerned that the globalization is over? Is it really over?
So, yeah, that's one of the big topics of our era, I believe. And the short answer is the type of globalization that we are used to or we have been used to is over. I remember in 1999, Kofi Annan, then Secretary General of the United Nations, has said, globalization is like gravity. You like it or not like it, it's there. It's unavoidable. Well, it's not like gravity. It turns out that globalization as we have known it was a product of a certain power structure where there was an undisputed hegemon, the United States, which was able to act as the final arbiter of any kind of debate, who was able to act as a sheriff, you know, if somebody started to cheat, came in and, you know, just somehow just spanked on the hand of the cheater. And that way you were able to sustain the rules of the game in globalization.
Yeah.
Now, there is a challenger to the United States, which is China, which is clearly no longer willing to play around the rules that were set by the United States and broadly by the West. And that challenge creates a new situation. And what we are seeing essentially since 2018, and it has sped up dramatically with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, is that there are two worlds. There is a China-centric world and there is a Western world. And the borders are being delineated as we speak. And within the borders of the Western world, the rules will be somewhat similar to what we have been used to. At the China-centric part of the world, it will be very, very different rule set from what we are used to. So if you are a company operating in the Czech Republic and trying to sell your product in Europe, from your perspective, globalization will not change dramatically. However, if you had a Chinese competition, then your situation will change dramatically. The way how we will all feel this is, first of all, we already feel it through inflation, right?
Yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah.
I think that it's pretty clear that there is a demand side of inflation, global inflation that we are seeing, and that is the stimulus that was provided to the economies during COVID. But at the same time, we are seeing that there is a very strong supply side element, and that is that the global supply chains have broken up. All of a sudden, everybody is thinking about safety of supply. And when you are thinking safety, you are not talking about efficiency. As anybody who did system dynamics know, you either optimize for efficiency or for safety. And all of a sudden, we started to optimize for safety, and that will be costlier. And if it is costlier, that means it will be inflation. So we are seeing the supply side part of inflation, and I think we will continue to see that for a while until the world adjusts to this new reality. And then it has a lot of ramifications to our lives, not only inflation. It's only those super, super cheap Chinese goods. Well, if they don't have chips in them, it's good. They can continue to come. If there is a chip in them, they will be restricted. They won't come here.
How does the impact of inflation play in your investment decisions? Because, for example, it's only slowly starting to be sort of accepted broadly, even within the well-known finance and business community. So for example, the very recent and latest letter to shareholders by Larry Fink of BlackRock, he actually devotes a pretty big chunk of that, you know, we're going to see the interest rates elevated and we're going to see higher inflation. And it's obviously because of this, you know, nearshoring, you know, simply creating, focusing on safety, focusing on everything you've discussed. It's just going to be costly and inflation is going to stay up. So how does that actually play your investment horizon? Do you have to actually make your funds, you know, the maturity or the long, you know, do you have to make them longer in terms of their time horizon? Do you have to look at different companies, or obviously valuations play their role?
So I think that the most important thing is you have to look for companies with pricing power, because you cannot predict where inflation will hit you. It is so prevalent in the global economy that it is, I mean, nobody can tell which product's price will go up 2 years from now. Really, nobody. And the only thing you can do is to try to have companies which have a market position which enables them to transfer the cost of their increasing raw materials and other input prices onto their customers. So all of a sudden, market pricing, pricing power becomes a more important phenomenon than previously, when there was nothing to shift over because there was no inflation. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a huge issue. I don't think that we have the toolkits. When I say we, then I say we as economics, have really the toolkit to provide easy assessments to identify the companies who really have pricing power. We have spent the better part of the last 2-3 years to try to just figure out for ourselves. Mm-hmm. We have been for quite a while in the inflation is here to stay camp, mostly because we are looking at this not strictly from an econ perspective, but mm-hmm. from a political economy perspective. Mm-hmm. And from a political economy perspective, the obvious way of handling inflation is simply untenable. Mm-hmm. So we think that for political reasons, inflation will be around for, you know, for at least the better half of this decade. Mm-hmm. So if that is the case, then the obvious idea you have as an investor is pricing power.
Since we are recording this on the 17th of March, 2023, we are just, you know, maybe a week after the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, a few days after, you know, reported problems at the Credit Suisse in Switzerland. What's going on with the global banking?
Okay, so this is partly personal. We were clients of Silicon Valley Bank. We were the only, to the best of our knowledge, we were the only clients.
How much of your deposit was uninsured?
I think this is to the credit of my team. We wired it out a day before it collapsed. So we sort of.
You listened to Peter Thiel.
We listened to Peter Thiel, also we listened to Gary Becker, the CEO. And you know, the moment was when the CEO was pleading that SVB has always been good for the Silicon Valley community, and he expects that the Silicon Valley community will be good to SVB. And venture capitals are not good to anybody.
You coming from private equity say that VCs are with sharper teeth?
What I'm saying is that Silicon Valley is a culture specifically. I'm not talking about venture capital here or venture capital in Europe, which I don't really understand. But Silicon Valley is really, you know, it's a wolf's lair. When you have to count on their goodwill, you're done. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the moment.
Is it a harbinger? Yes. Is it a harbinger of something worse coming, or is it just a very locally, very sort of industry specific one-off event?
Absolutely not. We believe that there are a lot of hidden weaknesses. There's this famous saying from Warren Buffett. It's when the tide, you know, everyone is swimming when the tide is up, when the tide is on. When the tide is off, it turns out who have been swimming naked. Mm-hmm. And this is what we are saying. This is what we are seeing now, because the incredible easy money, the availability of super cheap money really hid who were doing bad and who were doing good. So as a result, there was, as in every industry, there were a lot of bad performers. Plus, there was a lot of money out there, which was incredibly hard to invest wisely. Incredibly hard to invest wisely. So a lot of people did not invest it wisely. But we could not really see that, because you could always plug the hole with easy money. So what is happening now, easy money is slowly disappearing, and it has to disappear because the central banks has to fight inflation. And the only tool they know for fighting inflation is to increase interest rates. That is the only tool in the textbook. And then comes the trick. If they are increasing it too much, that means that the tide is going out too much, and then too many of the naked swimmers will be visible. So I think that what will happen in the coming years, and this is why I'm saying inflation will stay around, is that they will play the game, just as in the 70s. You have to play the game between politics and economics. You have to increase the interest rate to tackle inflation, but you cannot increase it so much that you really send a good part of your banking industry to bankruptcy. You cannot do that. So they will try to balance this. Just increase it a little bit and then release it. Increase, release. This is what the 70s have been all about. And when people are looking back to the 70s, they are assuming that, oh, central bankers were dumb. They just didn't know that you increase interest rates, you know, it just kills off demand, and the killing off of demand just kills off inflation. Well, they knew that. If you go back to the 70s and you actually read the papers that were written, they actually knew that. The thing is that politically it was impossible to do. And we are entering the same era. The problem is not that we don't know at the conceptual level what the central bank should do. The problem is that if you do that, you will do something to your economy that you don't want to do, because, I mean, just a few obvious things. You just had Donald Trump in 2016. If you are creating a big recession, what will prevent Donald Trump from coming back? You had Brexit in Europe. You had a lot of nasty characters popping up on the European political scene. So if you just push the economically super sound way of pushing down inflation, which is killing off demand, you are opening the door to these guys to come back. And that's not what anybody wants to do in the European or American policy elite.
You have to find the right balance between inflation doing all those bad things for you in a completely uncontrolled way, or you trying to sort of navigate it so you actually do get slapped over your fingers, but you hope that it's in a controlled way.
Exactly. So that's why we will have bank failures, a few of them, not many of them, not to the level where you get to a panic, but there needs to be some naked swimmers need to become visible, but it cannot be all at once, because then it's panic.
I really like that, you know, analogy to naked swimmers, but I always say to that, okay, but, you know, this is moral hazard. They should have put on their, you know, swimming trunks.
Yes.
It would have been absolutely fine. Guaranteeing, providing what Fed actually did over the past week, or the last weekend, you know, guaranteeing, you know, all deposits at SVB, it's just a humongous moral hazard.
Yes.
You know, exercise. What do you think about that?
I think that this was a political decision for two reasons. One, Silicon Valley lobbyists have convinced Washington, D.C. decision makers that without SVB, a good part of the tech infrastructure will collapse. That is a no-no for Washington, D.C., which is just gearing up to a major conflict with China. It may be a cold conflict. It may be a cold conflict, but it may be a hot conflict. And that conflict is clearly centered around technology now. It is actually centered around chip making.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, most of the Silicon Valley scene is now focused on pretty much like entertainment type of tech. While the Chinese are focusing what they call hard tech. They really want to be making chips.
I think that, I think that the U.S. is doing a lot for chip making. They just passed the Chip Act. So I think they realize it. But I agree with you. It has been an incredible misallocation of assets since 2008 to 2018. There's another famous saying, another very, very smart, astute observer, Senator Glenn, no longer around, used to be an astronaut. Mm-hmm. And he said that as of the promise of technology and digitization, he said, you promised me Mars colonies and all I got was Facebook. And this is really to the point, right? I agree. Misallocation of resources. The fact that VCs in the US have put most of the money into B2C and gadgetry and silly stuff.
And what we get is, surveillance capitalism and very smart, online advertising.
Absolutely. It was a complete misallocation of resources. I couldn't agree more. And the Chinese have done incredible catch-up as a result. And they have been, there are well-documented cases of state-organized theft, etc., etc. And the West was sleeping at the wheels. But that has changed. And since 2018, there has been a lot smarter approach to this problem. And as a result, there are important elements in the tech infrastructure which are focusing on things which are real, which are real value added, and especially which are important for armament. And this is why the tech industry has such a strong hand in Washington, D.C., because of this arms race which is shaping up around technology vis-a-vis China. Mm.
Says Christian Orban. Thank you for finding time to talk to us.
Thank you very much.